At Capella University, learning the right skills could make a difference. That's why our business programs teach you relevant skills you can take from the courseroom to the workplace. A different future is closer than you think with Capella University. Learn more at capella.edu.
From the makers of Rice-A-Roni comes Mac-A-Roni, a creamy, delicious boxed mac and cheese that's not just good, it's cheesy good. Mac-A-Roni will please even the pickiest eaters with two magnificent flavors that will melt your heart, creamy cheddar and creamy white cheddar. If you love cheese, you'll love Mac-A-Roni by the makers of Rice-A-Roni. If you don't love cheese, well, that's just unbelievable. Try Mac-A-Roni. It's cheesy good.
Mac-A-Roni, the San Francisco treat.
Taking Stock with Mandy Johnston, Sunday morning at 9.
Brought to you by PwC.
On News Talk.
You're all very welcome to Taking Stock. I'm Mandy Johnston. I'll be keeping you company here on News Talk for the next hour. And many regular listeners will know that this is the programme every week where we look at the stories that are shaping business and politics here in Ireland and all around the wider world. But today, as we edge ever closer to Christmas Day, it's crunch time for that gift buying. So in this special edition, we're bringing in some of our favourite contributors from the year to help you pick the perfect present for the business and political enthusiast in your life. Today, we'll be hearing from Joe Miller of the Financial Times. We'll also hear from Mark Paul from the Irish Times. He's going to be talking to us about his favourite book, which is the Boris Johnson book autobiography. Conall Thomas will be here from the Business Post with his top recommendation. It's called Autocracies by Anne Applebaum. And also we'll have Linda Daly from the Sunday Times. She'll be talking to us about the Catherine Sands book, which is called Drama Drives Interest, and it's all about the Web Summit. That's all ahead of us here on this festive edition of Taking Stock. Stay with us for those excellent last minute recommendations from all our special contributors. You can contact us at takingstock@newstalk.com, or we're always open on Twitter or X at StockNT. Now today we're going to kick off with this man.
Indeed, the best way to bring this country together would be, I think, to get Brexit done. And I absolutely do.
That was, of course, the unmistakable voice of former British Prime Minister Boris Johnson. And joining me now to discuss his autobiography is Mark Paul from the Irish Times. Mark, you're very welcome back to News Talk and happy Christmas to you.
Happy Christmas, Mandy.
Now, Mark, I was quite surprised that this is the book you chose. Tell us why you chose it.
Well, I suppose I chose it because I like a good rollicking read. Now, it was portrayed before it was released as the political memoir of the century, and I don't think it's that. The book Unleashed, it's 750 pages long, and in that 750 odd pages, there's not an awful lot of reflection from Boris Johnson. But what there is a whole load of anecdotes. Yeah, so one of the best anecdotes is a story that he tells about Joe Biden. Now, you know, Joe Biden, the president of the United States, was at the G7 in Cornwall in 2021, when Boris Johnson was the prime minister. And I think, you know, one of the reasons why I like this anecdote, I suppose maybe it's in a slightly masochistic way, is because he really needles Irish people and Joe Biden. And the anecdote is basically that Joe Biden tells Boris Johnson that, you know, not to believe any of this stuff that he thinks that his family are Irish, that Joe Biden believes actually that his family are English. And I think by repeating this anecdote, the truth, you know, I don't know whether it's true or whether it's not true, but Boris Johnson manages, I suppose, the feat of poking both Ireland and Joe Biden in the eye at the same time. And I think that just goes to the mischievousness of Boris Johnson and one of the reasons why I guess I like the book. Again, another, I suppose, a criticism of the book, Mandy, is that, you know, there isn't a lot of self-reflection by Boris Johnson in this book. He speaks all the time as if everything he's ever done was right. He's very defensive, very self-righteous, quite angry in places. But he is a good storyteller, and there's lots of other good tales. And there's a, you know, it's a treasure trove of anecdotes. One that really stood out for me was he talks about how Benjamin Netanyahu came to visit him when Boris Johnson was foreign secretary in 2017, and Netanyahu comes to visit him in the Foreign Office in Whitehall, which is a grand old building. And Boris Johnson brings him up to his office, where there's a desk there that was used by Arthur Balfour, who wrote the Balfour Declaration before 30 years before the creation of the State of Israel. And Netanyahu excuses himself to use the toilet. And Boris Johnson implies in the book very, very clearly that Benjamin Netanyahu left a listening device, a bug, in the toilet in the Foreign Office, in the annex off the Foreign Secretary's office. So these are the kind of stories that are in the book. And whilst you don't get a lot of self-reflection from Boris Johnson in this book, you do get great little tales like that.
Yeah, and actually, that's a really good point, because he is a great storyteller and spinner of yarns. But I'm just wondering, I haven't read the book yet, but I was speaking to a friend of mine who had read it, and they said it's ironic that the title is Unleashed, because this is probably the most contained, they'd kind of seen Boris Johnson in that sense. That is there anything more to know about him in this book than we already know?
Well, he doesn't. I mean, he certainly doesn't have any road to Damascus moment, right? And he doesn't. There's not a lot of unexpected self-reflection in the book. But I mean, maybe that tells you something in and of itself about Boris Johnson, that he's incapable of this. Another interesting aspect of the book is that, you know, he really did do it for the money. I think he got an advance of about £2 million to write this book, and sales haven't been brilliant. In the first week or so, I think it sold about 42,000 or 43,000 copies in the UK, and sales fell off a cliff after that. So Boris Johnson has still been running around right up until recently doing book tours in Australia and so on. And he's still trying to get sales of this book to 100,000 by Christmas. That was what he told Spectator magazine was his aim. So I think in order to sell the book, he lapsed into this mentality of telling anecdotes and colour and so on, but he still has yet to write a book in which he really, really, truly reflects on what he did as a politician and really engages in some self-criticism, I'd say.
Now, you're covering politics over in the UK every day and observing the people in the UK and their relationship with Boris Johnson now. Do you think, he'll ever be forgiven for what he did around COVID and Brexit? And do you think maybe that has something to do with the lackluster sales of the book, that there's just that little bit of resentment toward him, no matter how kind of gregarious a character he is or how entertaining he is? That legacy that he has is just still very sour with the British public.
I think that's a very fair point. There have been polls produced and surveys produced and published in British newspapers that show that a lot of British people in general don't believe some of the stories that he has in his book, and that they just find him an unbelievable character. I mean, to give you an example of another quite outlandish tale that's in it that I really enjoy reading in the book, but I'm not sure whether or not it's true. He talks about how during COVID, when the AstraZeneca vaccine was supposed to be exported from Europe to Britain, that the European Union refused to give an export license for it. And he talks about how he considered sending the British military into the Netherlands to take AstraZeneca vaccines by force and to spirit them back to Britain. Again, it's a great tale, and I have a soft spot for that kind of stuff. I just find it a good read. But I have no idea at all whether or not it's true, and I think the British people don't really believe Boris Johnson when he says these things. And I suppose, yes, that plays into what you said there about will he ever be forgiven for what he did during COVID. I don't know about that. I mean, I think there's a lot of people in the Tory party who would love to forgive him and bring him back, because they know he's a surefire electoral winner. And maybe deep within Boris Johnson, he feels he still has a chance of coming back as Tory leader. But I just don't know, Mandy. I think maybe Boris Johnson's race is run in that sense.
And what about the other side of him? Because, you know, his private life was almost as kind of interesting, fascinating and fantastic as his political career. Does he shed much light on his own family, whether it's the father, the brothers, the sister, or indeed his own children and his own family life? Do you see much of that in this book?
No, you don't really. I mean, he portrays it's a political memoir of his time at the top of politics. Really, he doesn't go too deeply into his family background. I mean, he portrays Carrie, his wife Carrie. He portrays a kind of an ordinary loving family situation between the two of them, and there's no evidence to suggest that that's not the case. And there's another anecdote in the book about how during COVID in August of 2020 they went on a family holiday to Skye when Carrie had a young baby, and how Boris Johnson says he almost drowned because to get away from the Scottish midges, he took an inflatable kayak out onto a lake, was blown off by the wind, and had to swim 600 metres to shore. So again, this is what you get in this book. You get colour, you get sort of after-dinner tales by Boris Johnson. And if you want a light read in that sense, it's great fun. But I suppose if you want an in-depth political memoir and based around true self-reflection and true self-criticism, and maybe this isn't a book.
Yeah, and that was his appeal really as well, as somebody who was involved in the newspaper industry as well as a columnist. He really knows the type of things that kind of catch the public imagination and attention. So in that sense, I'm looking forward to reading it over the Christmas. I 100% know somebody is going to buy it for me for sure. But who, if you're out there and you're doing your shop now, who actually might this appeal to?
I think this book, look, it will appeal to people probably who have a soft spot for politicians like Boris Johnson, who are full of the colour and the entertainment. And it won't appeal to you if you're looking for a hardcore chin-stroking political book, but it will appeal to you if you like a funny storyteller, and if you like somebody who's going to make you laugh, and if you like, a tongue-in-cheek, facetious style of writing. And one thing that Boris Johnson is, he's quite a good writer. He's got quite a great turn of phrase. And if you enjoy that, you'll enjoy this kind of book.
Well, that's a lovely phrase in itself, a tongue-in-cheek, facetious writer. And on that note, we leave it there. Mark Paul, thank you once again for joining us today, and thanks for all your contributions over the year. Thank you very much, Mark.
Thanks, Mandy.
You're listening to a special edition of Taking Stock, where we're going through some of our favourite contributors and their perfect picks for presents for you this Christmas. And we're looking at some books that they've enjoyed throughout the year. And joining me next on the line to do just that is Linda Daly of the Sunday Times. Linda, you're very welcome back.
Thanks, Mandy, for having
me. Now, Linda, tell us about the book you've chosen and why you picked this particular one.
Yeah, so I've chosen Drama Drives Interest, the Web Summit story, and it's by a journalist, Catherine Sands. Full disclosure, I used to work briefly with Catherine in the Sunday Times, but I bought this book and I absolutely loved it. Catherine has written a book about Paddy Cosgrave, the businessman, and his business, the Web Summit. But for those who don't know who Paddy Cosgrave or the Web Summit is, Paddy is an entrepreneur from Wicklow who, during the recession, started up the Web Summit, which is a big tech conference. It was kind of created in this big blaze of publicity during the recession, and it kind of added a bit of, I don't know, pizzazz to the Irish economy, and it was what we all needed at the time. And from those early days of 2009, 2010, it has grown into become one of the biggest tech conferences in Europe. But Paddy is a controversial figure, and in the last decade, he has been involved in a lot of controversies. It seems to have followed him around as he goes. And this book kind of details all of that. And it is absolutely fascinating. It is full of little bits of delightfully gossipy bits of info. And you just won't put it down.
And just on that, Linda, the title was the thing, I suppose, that drew me in. Firstly, Drama Drives Interest. You had an experience, actually, that demonstrate why this yourself, why this book might be called this.
Yes. So in the book, Catherine details why she called it Drama Drives Interest. So she had written a story about Paddy Cosgrave on one occasion, and he had sent her a text message saying it was a great story, she did a good job. But he took to Twitter, nowadays known as X, and he lambasted her on Twitter. She contacted him and said, "Why did you criticise me on Twitter, but compliment me publicly or privately rather?" And he said, "Drama drives interest." And I think that really showed good insight into his thinking of it. And John Maher did a review of the book in the Irish Independent and kind of echoed something similar that happened to him. So Paddy is a really controversial figure on social media. He is very critical of the government, very critical of Irish media. And I just think that just gave a little nugget into where his thinking is from, you know. And there's a great quote from him in the book where he said, petty squabbling is, if you can afford it, worth every penny.
Yeah, I have been all year I've been banging on about this back reference to an old tabloid phrase called if it bleeds, it leads. And it's that notion that negativity is the thing that draws people in. And I think it's a lot of the reasons why some of the politicians who we see as unorthodox, or some of the people as we see as are kind of controversial or antagonistic, they actually get an awful lot of attention because they understand that principle of negativity. And so I suppose that dichotomy within Paddy Cosgrove is what makes him brilliant at what he does, because he does capture attention and he does make the narrative his own.
Yeah, he does. So, I mean, but it has gotten him into trouble. Mm. So last year, when Hamas carried out their attack on Israel, he was very quick to tweet about it. And his tweet really just created a storm on X, because he was critical of the Israeli government from the off, before they had time to react to it. And because he has a big following, and because many of those people who follow him are business people, and some of them would have been Jewish or Israeli, that's when it really backfired on him. He was forced to apologise, and temporarily he stepped down from the role of chief executive of the Web Summit. The biggest companies in the world, Intel, Google, Meta, Siemens, they all pulled out of the conference in Lisbon that year. Now, look, it looks like it's come back. He's back in charge. I'm sure he'll be successful. He's brought his conference to Qatar as well. He's getting reported €20 million for that. But I just really think that this book, it kind of highlights he's fallen out with his business partners from the start, David Kelly and Dara Hickey, and there's high court cases and a case in the US ongoing there. So despite all this success that he has, it just kind of shows a couple of individuals who perhaps aren't happy, and it really kind of drives home the fact that you can have all this success but still not be 100% happy with your life, I have to say.
And does Catherine go into the period when because of course when the Web Summit started, it was here in Ireland, and it was a great boon, I suppose, to the Irish economy and to Dublin in particular. Does she go through that episode when Ireland actually lost the Web Summit?
She does, yeah. So she tells the details of what he was looking for. He had issues around the Wi-Fi in the RDS. He had issues around traffic. He was really critical online of the government, but also he got a lot of money from the government in support. So, I mean, there's a lot of bits in the book that kind of maybe perhaps show this two-sided character, his public-facing persona and the person who has created this really successful business, but also used government and his contacts to maybe perhaps leverage the business. And just great little nuggets, you know. There's a part where a journalist, I think it was for the Irish Times, had written about when the Web Summit had been set up. Paddy took he wasn't happy with this. He kind of had a different viewpoint of the year. I think it was something like 2010, 2009. Catherine has unearthed some information that would show that actually, despite him giving out to the journalist for getting it wrong, the journalist had actually gotten backup information from articles that Paddy had written himself. So just lots of little catty little nuggets like that you just won't want to put it down.
No.
And it really shows how a startup goes from being small to huge success too.
And tell me, did Catherine, and we've interviewed Catherine on this show as well about her other writings, did Catherine have access to him?
No, I don't think so. Originally, she did have it, and she tells a great story as well, how she used to always say to him, "You'll turn on me one day," in the hopes that he wouldn't. Eventually, actually, he did. I don't think he would deal with her for this book. So she would have had kind of dealings with him earlier on, and she was able to quote him on that, but he completely stopped. And as far as I know, he never responded to her about the book since. And he wasn't happy that it was published at all.
So look, it's obviously a big world of media and media influence and influencers and business. But who do you think, Linda, if you're somebody who's going out shopping today, might appreciate this book as a stocking filler?
Well, that's it. Carolyn Lillington in the Irish Times was a bit critical of it, saying that it didn't really go into the tech side of things. But I actually disagree with that. And I think, there's a reason for that. This is a book that will show anybody who's interested in businesses, about startups, about business relationships, anybody who has any interest in what putting a conference together is like, and also how to create somebody who's controversial. Anybody with any interest in personal relationships would be interested in this book. It doesn't go too deep into the nitty gritty, when that's what kind of keeps you hooked, because you will just keep reading for the next story, the next bit of information.
Well, it's not one that I had anticipated picking up, but I definitely will be picking it up for someone, if not myself. The book is called Drama Drives Interest. It's the story of the Web Summit. It's by Catherine Sands. And thank you very much, Linda Daly from the Sunday Times, for being with us today to take us through that. And thank you for your contributions throughout 2024. Wishing you and yours a happy Christmas. That was Linda Daly. Thank you very much.
Thanks a million.
You're listening to Taking Stock here on News Talk. After the break, I'll be joined by Conal Thomas from the Business Post to talk about his favourite book. It's called...
From the makers of Rice-A-Roni comes Macaroni, a creamy, delicious boxed mac and cheese that's not just good, it's cheesy good. Macaroni will please even the pickiest eaters with two magnificent flavours that will melt your heart. Creamy cheddar and creamy white cheddar. If you love cheese, you'll love Macaroni by the makers of Rice-A-Roni. If you don't love cheese, well, that's just... unbelievable. Try Macaroni. It's cheesy good.
Macaroni, the San Francisco treat.
At Capella University, learning the right skills could make a difference. That's why our business programs teach you relevant skills you can take from the courseroom to the workplace. A different future is closer than you think with Capella University. Learn more at capella.edu.
Parents want safer online experiences for their teens. That's why Instagram is introducing Teen Accounts, with automatic protections for who can contact teens and the content they can see, giving parents more peace of mind. Learn more at instagram.com/teenaccounts.
Serve up holiday magic from Whole Foods Market. Save on organic spiral-cut bone-in ham and curated cheeses. Plus, explore limited-time finds and gifts for every gathering. Shop Whole Foods Market in-store or online. Terms apply.
Autocracy. You're welcome back to Taking Stock. I'm Mandy Johnston, and you're listening to a special edition of the show. We're talking to some of our favourite contributors over the year, and they've picked their favourite book, and we're going through it with them in the hope that it'll help you with your last minute Christmas buys. Joining me now is Conal Thomas from the Business Post, and his recommendation is called Autocracy. It's by Anne Applebaum. Conal, you're very welcome back to Taking Stock.
Thanks very much, Mandy.
Why did you pick this book?
It was pretty terrifying. No, Autocracy Inc., basically. So Anne Applebaum is a renowned journalist and historian. She's written extensively about communism, the fall of the USSR. She's Pulitzer Prize winning. She writes for The Economist, The Atlantic. So anyway, this book basically is effectively a look at how autocracies and kleptocracies support each other around the world. So whether that's Russia, whether that's Venezuela, whether it's China, whether it's Iran, they're all effectively backing each other up. It's an interesting one. So there's a individual case studies in the book. I won't give too much away, but broadly speaking, in the way that the 1930s would have had ideological strongmen, so Mussolini, Hitler, we don't have that anymore. The modern autocrats, whether it's Putin, whether it's Maduro, whether it's Xi Jinping, they don't have that ideology. They claim to, but in reality, this is all about propping up their own power. And it's done effectively mainly through shady financial dealings, supporting each other with weapons. We saw that in the Ukraine war, where Iranian drones were used, North Korean troops were backing the invasion, Chinese technology was used. So the way that particular world order against what you might call Western liberal democracy operates is effectively to keep themselves in power, keep their wealth, and keep their people down through what we might call the information war. Mm. I'll give you a couple. I'm just going to read one passage.
Do. If yeah, it's okay. Please.
This is a good example of kind of how it spreads around the world. Kleptocracy and autocracy go hand in hand, reinforcing each other, but also undermining any other institutions that they touch. the real estate agents who don't ask too many questions in Sussex or Hampshire, the factory owners eager to unload failing businesses in Warren, the bankers in Sioux Falls happy to accept mystery deposits from mystery clients. All of them help undermine the rule of law in their own countries and around the world. The globalization of finance, the plethora of hiding places, and the benign tolerance that democracies have shown for foreign graft now give autocrats opportunities that few could have imagined a couple of decades ago.
Yeah, it's very interesting, you know, that sense that autocrats, as we know them, we would say there's autocrats all over the world now. You've referenced Putin in China, even some kind of would reference Trump in that way. Mm. But it's driven now in a different way, as you say, by power, by their own power, and a lot to do with wealth.
Yeah.
And how then, so like, how does it manifest itself for us as a people then, in a different way? So if the autocrats themselves has changed, does that change how we as citizens respond to it, and how our lives are affected?
Yeah, and I think what Anne Applebaum's done quite well is she's put forward, I think there's a couple of things about this book. It's overwhelming, in one sense, when you see the depth of how you know deep these connections go and how these regimes and autocrats support each other. But in terms of our own response, what she's calling for, there's an optimism there. She's calling for, you know, there has to be greater financial regulation to stop dirty money flowing into Western countries. In terms of the information war, what she would call the information war, we've seen this the last number of years, and really since 2016, since Brexit and Trump, and we're going to see a lot more of it, is this total lack of regulation. So these autocrats can you know, put propaganda out there, you know, and in up until now, really, the West has been trying to combat it through almost things like fact-checking, which is obviously a very legitimate journalistic tool. But by the time the claim has gone out there, by the time
it's too late, it's
too
gone,
late, and it has to be a deeper look at how you regulate these information systems.
And is this book then her kind of capturing that moment to say how acutely bad things are, or is this a kind of a making you understand the geopolitical interconnectedness? You keep using the word connected.
That's it. And it is. It's not just the autocrats and the autocratic countries that are connected and prop each other up. It's also their money flowing into the West. It's the fact that she does this great thing where she goes into the kind of the history of how the West enabled this as well in many ways. If you look at the, so go back at the early 1950s when Willy Brandt was the German economic minister, later chancellor, and decided, let's build the pipeline with Russia, and look where we are today.
Yeah, this
so
is Gazprom.
The West enabled this in the aftermath of the Second World War. What we have to do now is respond back to, and what she quite succinctly points out is that we also, you know, if you talk about Western liberal democracies, whether it's, you know, ourselves or whether it's Germany or whether it's the United States, we have to still work with these autocratic regimes on major
issues. That's right,
like
because that's where
change.
That connected thing comes in.
So there's a practical, I suppose, optimism there. But I think, like, it's setting out the world order. But Applebaum in the past has not, a thing I really liked about this book was that it doesn't sugarcoat how vast these networks are, how powerful, how they constantly prop each other up and keep each other in power. But at the same, like, and she has said before, kind of, I think she had a line in an article a few years ago, it's effectively that the bad guys are winning.
Mm-hmm.
So this isn't really, it's not telling people what to do. It's not telling the individual citizen, but it is, I suppose, a deep dive into a system that many people, and I think the thing that I found really interesting about it was that most people, when they think of autocrats or dictators, they think of the strong men. So they think of Putin and they think of you know, Lukashenko in Belarus, and they kind of still have this idea in their heads of Hitler and Mussolini. It's not that anymore. It's a lot seedier.
Like a malevolence. And,
there's a malevolence, but what I took away from the book as well is that just in terms of the, you know, the financial graft and corruption that goes on, it's how seedy these autocracies are. That was always there in a dictatorship.
Is there much about like oligarchs and the oligarchy, like, and that supporting that business
very
plus politics
so.
In? And tell me about that. And also, I want to know about how the book is structured, because that's often a very important way in which someone would decide to pick the book up or not? Like, is it, yeah. Does it focus on country by country?
Yeah,
is it a narrative?
It kind of gives case study by Belarus, again, goes to Zimbabwe, it goes to Venezuela, and it just, it's this great weaving narrative showing how they're kind of all connected.
Mm.
But just on the oligarchs, it's interesting, particularly when we're talking about, Ukraine and Russia's invasion, how that's, and there's one really interesting thing that she goes into is something I wasn't really aware of, was how Putin cemented his control from his early days as deputy mayor of St. Petersburg by gifting these contracts out to his friends, and that is effectively what has propped up the Russian state. But there's one interesting anecdote in it she has, where it's about a Russian oligarch, whose wife, I think Russia's only billionaire, buys a home in a small town in England. I can't remember the name of it. And she was curious about this. She thought, why is Russia's only female billionaire buying? Okay, let's look at this. So, and this is where you get into the kind of, you know, the seedy sort of, you know, where does the money go? And she looks on the property price register in England, and it's sold for £5.5 billion. But there's no name attached to it. There's this holding company attached to it. And it was only, she includes this in the book, and I think she wrote an article, maybe it was for the New York Times at the time, where she mentioned this anecdote. And she said, I only knew it was Russia's only female billionaire because I saw her husband and his lawyer in the local pub.
Jesus. Like how small, yeah. You know, a little small community.
But how it spreads.
Yeah.
And also she makes this case as well about, you know, how, like, let's face it, Western financial institutions have not been questioning enough about where this money is coming from.
Yeah.
You know, and what's interesting is, well, we're seeing actually just this year, was it, there was this big discussion in Europe about AMLA, which is the Anti-Money Laundering Authority, which we
pitching to get.
Yeah, we bid quite strongly, and it ultimately went to Frankfurt.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things she's calling for is, as I say, that greater financial regulation. So this is one of those things, I can almost see this book, like, almost like a revised edition in 10 years,
right,
to see how things go.
To see
that
how they
sense.
Can. Yeah, no, absolutely.
And also then, one of the other interesting, really darker things about it, I suppose, is how Putin was enabled to carry out the invasion of Ukraine. And it has almost led to a domino effect of further conflict,
mm-hmm.
you know, in Israel, in the Middle East. And so the more these autocrats are propped up, the more others are going to be looking at them going, well, hold on a second, if I can get away with this.
Yeah, and the consequences of those relationships and what pans out from different regimes coming in. Very quickly, I could talk to you about this for another hour, I'm sure. But very quickly, I've asked all the guests this today, Conal, who would you buy this book for?
Anyone interested in politics or global finance.
Well, that's good enough.
Yeah.
That's good enough for me. I'll definitely be picking up a copy of that. Conal, thank you very much for coming in to me today. The book was called Autocracy by Anne Applebaum. And that was Conal Thomas from The Business Post. Thank you very much for coming into us today.
Thanks, Mandy.
You're listening to Taking Stock here on News Talk. After the break, we'll be talking to Joe Miller from the Financial Times.
As a parent, you want what's best for your teen. You want them to grow and thrive in this world. But you also want to make sure they're staying safe. That's why Instagram is introducing teen accounts, with automatic protections for who can contact teens and the content they can see. Instagram teen accounts, built-in limits for teens, and peace of mind for parents. Learn more at instagram.com/teenaccounts.
At Capella University, learning the right skills could make a difference. That's why our business programs teach you relevant skills you can take from the courseroom to the workplace. A different future is closer than you think with Capella University. Learn more at capella.edu.
Serve up holiday magic from Whole Foods Market. Save on organic spiral cut bone-in ham and curated cheeses. Plus, explore limited time finds and gifts for every gathering. Shop Whole Foods Market in-store or online. Terms apply.
From the makers of Rice-A-Roni comes Mac-A-Roni, a creamy, delicious boxed mac and cheese that's not just good, it's cheesy good. Mac-A-Roni will please even the pickiest eaters with two magnificent flavors that will melt your heart, creamy cheddar and creamy white cheddar. If you love cheese, you'll love Mac-A-Roni by the makers of Rice-A-Roni. If you don't love cheese, well, that's just unbelievable. Try Mac-A-Roni. It's cheesy good.
Mac-A-Roni. The San Francisco treat.
Thanks. You're welcome back to Taking Stock. I'm Mandy Johnston, and you're listening to a special edition of Taking Stock, where we're talking to some of our favourite contributors over the year, and they're picking their perfect present for the enthusiast of business and politics in their life to help you with your last minute Christmas shopping. And joining me next on the line is Joe Miller from the Financial Times. Now, in Washington, Joe, you're very welcome back to Taking Stock.
Thank you, Mandy.
Now, Joe, actually, the book you've chosen is very intriguing for a number of reasons. You've chosen Freedom by Angela Merkel. And when we first started to talk to you on this program, I think you were the Financial Times correspondent in Germany.
I was indeed. And I think my, well, at least the first few years of my career were spent reporting more on Merkel than on any other international figure. So I've been waiting for this book with bated breath.
And when you got it and read it, were you surprised, disappointed, or delighted?
Well, I should start with two disclaimers. One is that Angela Merkel said some nice things about my book. So I feel I have somewhat of an undeclared bias here when reading her biography. And the second is to say that it's 720 pages long and I'm not quite at the end of it yet. but all that is to say, I mean, I think for anyone who has any interest in geopolitics, in Europe, in the Ukraine war, in the lack of competitiveness in Germany and in the surrounding economies, I think this is a crucial read, if not a particularly exciting one. Angela Merkel is not someone who is prone to sort of spill the beans and to salacious gossip. Mm. And much of what she chronicles is quite dull and has been out there for some time. But nonetheless, I think charting her extraordinary life, really, from growing up in East Germany, watching the Berlin Wall come down, to leading a country, you know, one of the largest democracies in the world for 16 years, which when you think about it now is just, you know, unimaginable that we would have any of the leaders that are currently in post be there for more than, you know, 4 or 5 years, never mind for 16 years. I think it's an interesting study in how, you know, you can have such longevity and what the necessary ingredients are. And for that reason, I think, you know, if you have the staying power to get through the 720 pages, it is rewarding in that sense, if not exhilarating.
Well, I'm glad that you're positive about the book, because I'm sure that Angela herself is one of the regular listeners to Taking Stock every week. So if she's tuning in, I'm sure she'd be delighted with that. But earlier in this programme, we spoke to Mark Paul of the Irish Times, and the book that he had chosen to review was Boris Johnson's book, Unleashed. And almost the polar opposite of what you're saying about this book, which you're saying this is important if you're trying to understand the world, may not necessarily be a rip-roaring, enjoyable read. But his was the opposite. The Boris Johnson had lots of anecdotes, but you're not actually going to come away with anything substantive from his book. So this is a more kind of considered understanding of the world and her, I take it. Is it a memoir? Is it an autobiography? Like, what is the book?
That's a very good question. And I would say, actually, that there are some similarities between the Boris Johnson book and Angela Merkel's, bizarrely. I haven't read Boris Johnson's book fully, but I've read some extracts. And from what I gather, he is very much in the, you know, no regrets mode. And, you know, I was stitched up, etc. Mm. And in Angela Merkel would never state it so starkly. But her legacy obviously has been tarnished by events that have taken place since her leaving office. Her policy towards Russia, which was very conciliatory, now looks very naive. Her lack of insisting on Germany's energy independence seems to have put Europe's largest economy in some peril. The immigration crisis that she handled to such acclaim by, you know, letting in roughly 1 million migrants conference in 2015 and leading the way and saying that Europe could deal with that. You know, that hasn't ended up playing out very well, et cetera, et cetera. And you would expect this book to be full of more introspection. And while you do get a lot of Angela Merkel saying, you know, oh, you know, these were the things I was dealing with. This is what people in my cabinet were saying. No one was pushing back on this idea. It seemed the right thing to do at the time, et cetera, et cetera. I couldn't afford to antagonize Putin. And many, you know, kind of, she gives some rationale for these decisions. Nonetheless, I have not yet reached a sentence where she says, you know, I think I did the wrong thing. I can now see in hindsight that I failed to lead when I should have, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, I think she would bridle at the suggestion that there was any similarity between her and Boris Johnson. But in some ways, if not in terms of rhetoric, there is.
Very interesting. I read a quote in one of the reviews, I think it was The Guardian, about the book, and it said the former German Chancellor slights her enemies by barely mentioning them and is frustratingly opaque on her own big calls. You get a sense of that as well.
I do. I mean, I think that the, you know, there's been a fair amount of negative reviews out there since the book came out, all to the same tune of what you mentioned there, which is that, you know, she doesn't really go into too much detail. It does seem like, or it can seem like, she's hiding something. I would want to offer a defense of her, which I don't think is necessarily one she would embrace, which is, I don't think there necessarily is a deeper layer to some of her decisions or some of her motivations. I think the interesting thing about Merkel was always that there was this towering figure at the center of European politics, of global politics, who became especially more important when Donald Trump got into office. And everyone was always, you know, searching for what made her tick. And she would offer the same stories about, you know, growing up in the GDR and valuing freedom. But really beyond that, she doesn't really seem to have any animating ideals. And when you look at, you know, the key topics and the key decisions, you see that she did flip-flop quite a lot. For someone who is known as being so resolute, she went from, you know, as a scientist, embracing nuclear energy to, after the Fukushima disaster, saying that Germany would, no longer have any nuclear plants. She went from being an enthusiastic supporter of the so-called debt brake, which restricts how much Germany can borrow and forces it to have balanced budgets, to writing in this book that she thinks that might need to be revisited. She also has, you know, wavered one way or another on migration, taking a tough stance, and then obviously in 2015 deciding to open Germany's borders. And I think if you want to be unflattering towards her, you could say that what she was very good at was managing to stay in the middle, resolutely in the middle of German politics, of putting her finger in the air and seeing which way the wind was blowing. You know, I can remember being there when Germany finally voted to legalize same-sex marriage. And, you know, she had been against that personally, but did not stand in the way of it being voted through. And, you know, that's a perfect example of her managing to play both sides, because she could say to her conservative base, you know, I'm against this, but then to the rest of the world, it was Germany has legalized same-sex marriage, and she got the credit for that because she had, you know, been chancellor at the time. And so, you know, I think you could come away from reading this book thinking, this is just someone who's incredibly adroit at managing to stay where the country is, where her voters are, where the majority of voters are. Yeah. And there's not necessarily an animating ideology behind her.
Yeah, that's very interesting. And as you say, that refugee crisis of 2015, 2016, and the decision she took around Germany's borders, you know, she was applauded and lauded for those decisions at the time. But she strikes me as someone whose reputation was better in the job than out of it. And that's always a lot to do with, you know, what's happening in the country now. So the timing of the book as well, similar to Boris Johnson and the relationship that she now has with the German people is a very interesting one, maybe still being blamed for the difficulties that they're going through now. But Joe, you're heading out shopping now today. Who would like this book, do you think, if you're heading out looking for a book for someone, what type of person would enjoy this book?
I really think anyone who's interested in working out how the centre left, centre right get back into power, what it would take for us to have quote unquote normal politicians again, for those of us who are, you know, kind of still startled at the rise of populists around the globe. I mean, this is the last successful, you know, really successful centrist politician of our age telling us about how she got there and how she made her decisions. And I think, you know, if you want to take any lessons away from that for how, you know, to go forward, I think there are, the main lesson is not to do it the way she did it, really, because it seems that she was incredibly lucky and, you know, understood German society at a particular point in time, but that even though she was around for 16 years, not many of those policies have lasted in the long run, and there's probably a need for a rethink. So I think anyone who's interested in how we reshape, you know, democratic politics should read this book. Not as an instruction manual, but probably as the opposite.
As the opposite. Well, Joe, listen, we really do appreciate you taking the time today to come and to tell us about the book. The book is Angela Merkel, Freedom. Joe Miller, thank you very much for being with us, and happy Christmas to you and all of your family.
You're most welcome, and happy Christmas to you.
Thank you. Well, that's it for this episode of Taking Stock. Just a reminder that while we broadcast at this time on Sunday mornings, we're always available as a podcast first on Friday mornings on the News Talk app. You can listen back to any of the previous programs there. Thanks as always to all of today's guests for their very valuable time and their recommendations this week, which I'm sure will be helpful to you as you head out for that last minute Christmas shopping. Thanks to the series producer of Taking Stock, John Fardy, and Stephen Daunt and Simon Keane were on research, and Hugo Silva-Scott was on sound. If you have any comments on today's items, do email us at takingstock@newstalk.com. But from Taking Stock with me, Mandy Johnston, enjoy the rest of your day. We hope you have a wonderful Christmas. Thanks for listening throughout the year. Happy shopping, and we leave you with The Power of Love by Frankie Goes to Hollywood.
I'll protect you from the hooded claw. Keep the vampires from your door. Feels like fire. I'm so in love with you. Dreams are like angels. They keep bad at bay, bad at bay. Love is the light, scaring darkness away. Yeah. I'm so in love with you. Purge the soul.
Taking Stock with Mandy Johnston. Sunday morning at 9.
Brought to you by PwC.
On News Talk.
Is it time to reimagine your future? The right business skills may make a difference in your career. At Capella University, we offer a relevant education that's designed to focus on what you need to know in the business world. We'll teach professional skills to help you pursue your goals, like business management, strategic planning, and effective communication. And you can apply these skills right away. A different future is closer than you think with Capella University. Learn more at capella.edu.